I don't know about you, but I see things like this all the time. I have also heard more times than I can count that heroes are boring, that villains are more interesting, and that anti-heroes are apparently where it's really at. These days, I'd probably have to partly agree. Heroes are boring. The thing is, though, heroes are not supposed to be boring. I grew up with a great love for a whole wide range of heroic characters. But there really is no getting around the fact that heroes have become very, very dull. But how is it that heroes became so dull? When did we start calling every character and their brother-in-law an anti-hero? Why is it so hard to define morality in characters? And why is everyone so obsessed with making villains into the good guys, and vice versa? We're going to save our discussion about villains for another day. We already have way too much ground to cover. For today, we're going to focus on heroes, and to a slightly lesser degree, anti-heroes. To start with, let's talk about heroes. Currently, a lot of written variations on heroic characters have one or more of these three primary problems. The writer assumes that the hero cannot have any significant flaws, especially moral flaws, nor can they have a different moral opinion or be morally inferior to themselves or any other good character in the story. Heroes are not permitted to develop in terms of moral character, but must begin and end with the same overall characteristic, especially morally. And heroes must necessarily represent the writer's moral opinion about the real world, regardless of what is occurring within the world of the story. In my search for a single definition of hero, Google told me this. A fictional hero is a character in a story who possesses extraordinary qualities and abilities, and who is typically admired for their courage, strength, or noble deeds. Weirdly specific and weirdly vague at the same time. These are the types of phrases you'll see a lot when you try to define hero characters. Conventional heroism, noble qualities, strength, strong moral compass, etc., etc. The internet in general is hesitant to define hero. I can't decide if that's because they don't know or because they instinctively realize that it's unhelpful to be so randomly restrictive. Most of the lectures I have seen or the essays I have read on this topic treat characters as if they all necessarily must fit into some category or other. When a new type of character appears who doesn't seem to fit into any of these categories, they just invent new categories. It's a completely nonsensical way to approach characters. According to the dictionary, volume 5 of the 1933 Oxford English Dictionary, to be exact, there are 5 definitions for the word hero, all very similar. I'll put the first 3 on the screen so you can read them, but I want you to pay special attention to the 4th definition. The man who forms the subject of an epic, the chief male personage in a poem, play, or story, he in whom the interest of the story or plot is centered. Originally, and indeed in most academic settings, a hero is little more than the male main character of a story, with, of course, a heroine being a female main character. What's important to note here is that historically, on average, the majority of writers did not need to be told what specific traits they ought to give their heroic characters in order for readers to perceive them as heroic. Many characters from older works possess a whole array of traits, some good, some bad. Typically speaking, once measured in full, you do tend to see more of a good person than a bad person, but now we're getting into tricky territory. There are some writing resources that will say basically the same thing I just said, that heroes can still have flaws, can still be selfish, weak, etc., can still be just regular people trying to get by. But even when a modern-day writer is equipped with that knowledge, the idea of taking a regular person, a normal character, and crafting that person together with all their flaws into someone with a moral compass pointed solidly at good, in these days, apparently, is very, very hard. Why? Like it or not, the fictional representation of heroism, virtue, and morality in media is necessarily reliant on the writer's understanding of heroism, virtue, and morality. And these days, very few people, never mind writers, really understand these things. And even if they do, even if most writers could, to some degree, be considered moral individuals, that doesn't mean that they will understand the immense moral complexities that they attempt to write for their characters. So it follows that the characters will inevitably have less and less moral realism, resulting in less and less compelling or interesting heroes. If a writer doesn't understand true morality, how can the morality of their characters be interesting, complex, or in any way true to real life? Basically, In order to write morality in characters, especially complex morality, you have to understand morality yourself. I mean, really understand it, not just have some vague, undefined opinion on the matter. And this is a line of thought that is simply no longer explored in our society. It's no wonder all characters are moral mush, and heroes especially are enormously boring. So, what to do? Most writers, and even a lot of people these days, don't really even realize that morality is an area of study or something that you can learn about. Most writers don't realize that morality needs to be considered when constructing heroes or any character. Yet, it's impossible to really define heroism without talking about morality. Even if writers and teachers do understand that such a thing is essential to the study of heroes and heroic characters, most are hesitant to venture into moral territory. What if someone disagrees with you? What if you get canceled on the internet? There is definitely an aspect of fear at play. A lot of writers are afraid. So instead, when they're trying to build characters, especially heroes and anti-heroes, writers will instead focus mainly on those formulaic set of requirements that you find all over the internet, that everyone more or less agrees on, kind of, I guess. These categories seem to list traits and qualities that each of these character classes must possess, like saying only a car with four doors can be considered a sedan, and so on. Which is, I guess, great if you're trying to classify cars, but in my experience, humans are not so easily defined. And so why should our characters be? Writers who find themselves unable or unwilling to navigate the complex moral landscape in which they've placed their heroes will find that it is difficult to understand, and therefore to write, how a hero who does some bad things or who has serious flaws is still a hero. This can't be reconciled with the more commonly popular and excessively simplistic understanding of morality today. The resulting hero will then be an incredibly boring cardboard cutout who does little more than parrot the popular moral and ethical hot words of current year, while otherwise expressing very little of any moral opinion of any kind. This is boring, everyone knows it. Therefore, the more attractive and easier solution is to skip morality and simply make an anti-hero. Yet, somehow, even the anti-heroes are also boring. How is this happening? So, what is an anti-hero? This is the only non-internet definition of anti-hero I could find. This is Bennett's Reader's Encyclopedia from 1996. Their definition of anti-hero is a protagonist who lacks traditional heroic virtues and noble qualities and is sometimes inept, cowardly, stupid, or dishonest, yet sensitive. This definition honestly makes me so mad that if my version of this book wasn't digital, I'd probably be flinging it out of the window right now. First of all, the same book offers no definition of hero, if you can believe it, and obviously never elaborates on these traditional heroic virtues and noble qualities. This second part here that talks about anti-heroes being inept, etc., is arbitrary in the extreme. I can think of a dozen characters deemed heroes in the traditional sense who possess some or all of these qualities, if only at some point in their development. But this last part here is probably the root of all our problems. According to the folks who cobbled together this definition, an anti-hero is, despite all his flaws, sensitive. I know I'm not the only person to have noticed this, but in today's world, the only metric by which morality seems to be able to be measured is one of feelings. These days, the only means by which people learn to understand what morality is by determining whether or not the thing makes them feel good. Never mind that feelings are inherently subjective. If something makes them feel bad, it must be immoral. If something makes them feel good, it must be morally acceptable, no matter what it is. Morality, in reality, has very little, if anything, to do with a person's feelings. If a person fails to learn the absolutes of morality, they will never be able to convey its nuances. This idea that an anti-hero is blah 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 noble traits and yada 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 conventional heroism, but must above all be sensitive, is referring specifically to this. In some way, this anti-hero either must himself be sensitive to the plight and therefore the feelings of others, or more often must himself tug at the sensitive feelings of the audience. Reducing morality to a matter strictly of emotion is how you get these incredibly disturbing occurrences like audiences growing sympathetic enough towards the likes of Jeffrey Dahmer that they find him to be not responsible for his crimes, or even find his crimes to be not so bad or even justifiable. The writers themselves, despite their claims to the contrary, seem to be perhaps unintentionally leaning in this direction, tugging at the natural tendency of audiences to feel empathy for characters who are suffering, guiding the moral interpretation of their tale in such a way to stir up feelings of uncomfortable sympathy for its real-life titular serial killer, as a kind of shortcut to compelling writing. This is a closely related problem. Most writers these days falsely equate these feelings of discomfort with actual good writing. If they've made their audience feel uncomfortable, then they've succeeded in writing a compelling character, or so they assume. When the reality was that Netflix's Dahmer character was uncomfortable because the writer's assessment and presentation of morality was so upside down. On top of that, audiences could only assess Dahmer's morality based on feelings. So if he made them feel sorry for him, that must mean he's not bad. This kind of childish approach to morality is the most common today. Finding themselves compelled to feel sympathy for a sadistic serial killer made viewers uncomfortable. Not because it was compelling, but because it was an affront to basic morality. It's the same mechanic as the one at play when we feel uncomfortable watching a sexual assault scene. It's not because it's compelling or well-written or realistic or anything else, it's because it's violently assaulting our understanding of morality. However, many are only able to assess the morality at play in a scene of sexual assault based on the feelings it evokes. Because it upsets them or makes them feel sad, that's how they are able to determine that the act depicted must be immoral. When scenes of this nature are written in such a way to attempt to downgrade those feelings of revulsion or discomfort, some audiences will call this compelling and will be less able to assess the morality because they don't find themselves feeling particularly bad, given the deliberate writing. Audiences, and as it happens, writers, who have not properly or adequately trained themselves in their understanding of morality, will interpret these feelings of sympathy for Dahmer or an assault victim as moral judgment. I feel sorry for him, therefore he must not be morally bad. Which is a big reason why writers often use this method to make characters more sympathetic. They make the character a victim of something, thereby causing the audience to feel sorry for them, and thus soften their moral judgment. All of this because all parties involved, writers and audiences, are wrongly using emotions to judge morality. In order to build, from scratch, a morally complex or at least interesting character, and also in order for the writer to know whether that character is a hero, an anti-hero, or a villain, the writer has to have some very firm, very basic understanding of objective, non-emotionally driven morality. The more complex the story's moral landscape, the more complex the writer's understanding must be. This is why so many of the big, masterful writers spend so long studying morality and philosophy and struggling to wrap their ordinary person minds around extraordinary moral circumstances. It's hard work. They don't always get it right, but it results in genuinely compelling literature. And most people, and most writers these days, simply do not have that breadth of understanding. You can absolutely gain that kind of knowledge, but as I said, it's hard work. Most people don't even realize that morality is not an emotional matter. Writers seem to find no real benefit in exploring morality in any sense other than how it makes them feel and how they can use it to affect the emotions of their readers. But, I mean, think about it. If the only thing that the writer has used to build the morality of the written world and the characters is how it makes him or her feel, the chances that such morality will resonate with another person are 10,000 to 1. You'd have to find a reader who feels the same way about all these things as you do, and then you'd have to hope that your feelings while writing adequately portrayed the morals, and that the reader's feelings while reading happen to be just in sync enough to receive that portrayal as you intended. Everyone else will read and not have a single clue what kind of morality you've got going on there, or about the morality of the characters, heroes, anti-heroes, or villains, and will probably be bored or underwhelmed with the characters, or they'll feel very differently about them, leading them to interpret your heroic characters as monsters and your monsters as compelling anti-heroes. This isn't just poor writing, it results in an ongoing proliferation of very poor understanding of morality in general. And there's plenty of science out there to support the idea that human beings form a lot of their moral opinions by ingesting fiction, especially at younger ages. And I'm not saying that all characters have to be beacons of morality. The trick there is for the flaws to be written as flaws within the moral landscape of the story. A character can be the most morally complex guy on the planet, but the writing needs to also acknowledge this fact, which means that the writer needs to understand the moral clay with which the morally complex guy has been formed. And that clay does not include emotions. I love heroes with flaws. I love tragic heroes who become villains. Like most people, I find such characters wonderfully fascinating. Not because I find the flaws themselves fascinating, and in truth, I believe that's not what it is about flawed characters that draws us to them. It's the potential for growth that delights me. Nothing thrills me more than a character who either takes responsibility for his flaws and then makes himself better, or conversely, a character who is overcome by his flaws and becomes a tragic character. However, no matter how flawed or not flawed or how well written such a character is, everything about that character will fall flat if the foundational morality on which he is built is itself either unstable and uncertain or wholly erroneous. That is to say, if a writer doesn't understand basic morality, then how can they even begin to write morally complex characters? Most often, if a writer doesn't wish to bother with such things, they'll make their characters as amoral as they can. While amoral characters can be interesting, attempting to insert such a character into a world which itself also has no clear morality, the complexity that results will actually be terribly simplistic. The only real foundational baseline in such a story is that anything goes. Everyone's mostly bad at heart, and it only really matters in terms of how it makes us feel. Books and films and shows like this often use shocking or revolting plot events to manipulate the emotions of the audience into thinking that they're looking at a matter of compelling moral ambiguity. As I said before, more and more, evoking discomfort in the audience has been conflated with good writing for exactly this reason. It's pretty easy to manipulate the audience's emotions, especially if that audience is not inclined to look any deeper than emotion. Some less skilled or less experienced writers will attempt to build a heroic character into one who is morally ambiguous, but again, doing so only in this way. Which traits can I give this guy that make me personally feel bad? Those are the ones I'll give him, and then he'll be morally ambiguous. Whether or not he actually is morally ambiguous is a roll of the dice. It depends on how the writer felt about various things, how they felt that day, what mood they were in, and so forth. The odds that actually morally ambiguous things will make the writer feel bad are about 50-50, I'd say. But even then, most of these writers have never bothered to sit down and understand why, objectively, those bad traits are bad beyond the fact that they make them feel bad. So if they try to explain, within the world of the story, why these various traits and behaviors make this character morally ambiguous, there's simply no logic to it beyond the fact that it has some kind of negative emotional impact on the other characters, and also obviously the reader. This also leads you to those really contradictory characters. Men who have no problem keeping a woman captive, but then when they go to war, they absolutely refuse to do anything as inhumane as taking prisoners, and instead let them all go. And I don't mean this in terms of organically conflicted or hypocritical characters. This is rather a clear indicator that the writer is using nothing more than emotions to build morality. I mean, it all depends on how the given event makes the writer feel emotionally. If they feel too bad about taking war prisoners, they'll deem that a moral line the character can't cross, perhaps. If they feel, good-ish about the guy taking a lady he likes captive, well, that's a nice moral gray area to them. It all just depends on how everybody feels, I guess. Here's the thing. If you understand basic morality, or especially complex morality, you could actually write a heroic character who is deeply flawed without being morally ambiguous. We spent a decent amount of time speaking in generalities, so I think now is a good time to whip out some examples. Given the state of modern media, if we want to find a genuinely heroic character written well who also has significant flaws, we'll have to go pretty far back in time to 2000's The Patriot and have a close look at one Benjamin Martin. An important thing to remember when you're looking at this character, there's a big difference between characters who are morally ambiguous and characters who have flaws. Mel Gibson's wonderful Benjamin Martin is a very, very heroic character. Let me rephrase that. He's an extremely morally upright character. He has built his character and his life around doing the right thing in every situation. The right thing isn't always obvious, but he's always trying to find it. He's always trying to be a good man and a good father, but he has one very, very big flaw: his temper. It's shown early with the rocking chair incident, and hinted at with his past acts of furious violence during other military conflicts. He understands these past acts not as injustices in themselves, as they had been carried out as a necessary response to a brutal massacre, but as instances in which he lost his temper and therefore his head, acting on emotion instead of with reason, resulting in behavior that would be more in keeping with an animal than a thinking man. Interestingly, with Benjamin Martin, his efforts to combat that flaw by maintaining a firmly neutral stance in the building Revolutionary War created a kind of secondary flaw that was somewhat similar to cowardice. Obviously, it wasn't cowardice, it was actually far more complex, but it nevertheless led directly to the shocking murder of his young son by a sadistic redcoat. His fear of his flaw led him to overcorrect with inaction. Even when war was at his doorstep, he attempted to reason calmly with the man preparing to destroy his home and hang his son as a spy. His attempts to avoid the fury of his own temper meant that he was weakened to the point that he was easy picking for a villain looking to make an example of him. It was only after the damage had been done and he saw the result of his mistake that he loaded his guns and literally went to war. Doing so, by the way, was not depicted as wrong. In fact, this moral point is brought home very poetically when Martin's sister-in-law tells him, after he massacred the men who destroyed his home, "You've done nothing for which you should be ashamed." To which he replied, "I've done nothing, for that I am ashamed." My movie writing used to be good. Because of the true moral complexity of this exceptionally drawn character, he could remain entirely heroic despite the constant inner battle he was fighting against his ferocious temper. True moral questions could be asked, which were very hard to answer. If his terrible temper turned him into a monster, were his monstrous actions justified if carried out for the right reason? If he refused to fight in order to avoid his temper, were his inactions actually cowardice? Did inaction do more harm? It sounds simple, but this solid moral ground creates deep complexity without moral ambiguity. A point worth noting. On one occasion, when Colonel Tavington antagonized him about his dead son, Benjamin Martin very calmly vowed to kill him before the war was done. In the end, he did just that. There was no hint of gray in this act. Avenging his murdered children was a natural and right thing for him to do, morally speaking. The trick for him was to do so calmly, without being controlled by the emotional rage of his temper. He had failed when fear had led him to inaction, resulting in the death of one of his sons. He had failed again in the opening fight when he had brutally taken his hatchet to that redcoat while trying to save his other son. He had failed again when he shot men who had been surrendering. For Martin, the climactic final development of his character was whether or not he could fulfill his duty as a patriot and as a father without becoming a slave to his emotions. What's important to see here is that the writer of Benjamin Martin had a firm grasp on the objective morality of the world in which Martin was placed, and also on morality in the real world, that of the audience who would watch the film. As such, this character could be portrayed with crisp, glowing heroism and deep, uncomfortable flaws. He was real, but he was admirable. If anything, his flaws and his constant struggle to overcome them made him even more admirable. None of this would have been possible had the character or the world been written with an emotionally based, uncertain, subjective morality. If Martin's various character flaws had been judged based solely on how they made their characters or the audience feel, then the actual morality of the character himself would have been very vague and wishy-washy. The writer had clearly made an effort to understand the objective morality at play in the life of an 18th century colonial soldier. The world itself was painted with moral absolutes. Thus, the heroism of Benjamin Martin was able to shine on its own power. Let's look at another flawed hero. This one, however, is these days often labeled an anti-hero, which is so baffling that I almost find it insulting. This time we're going even farther back, all the way to 1972's Rambo First Blood. John Rambo is objectively heroic in many respects. He's a military veteran who managed to find a way to fight as honorably as he could within a very ugly, ugly war. He was drafted, used by his government, abandoned, vilified, and left with nothing. But he remained calm, kind even, level-headed, respectful. When he was trying to find one of his former squad mates, he was incredibly polite when he was asking around, and extremely delicate and respectful when talking to the man's surviving family members. By all appearances, John Rambo was a very good man who just wanted to try to live what was left of his life. But he was waylaid by the pronounced belligerence of some scumbag sheriff. Even then, he didn't respond with hostility. It wasn't until they actually did violence that he responded with violence. As he said again and again, they drew first blood. His flaw was even more complex than Benjamin Martin's. It couldn't even be described as something as straightforward as PTSD, however straightforward that could be. Rambo had been conditioned with a certain firm moral code. which was to protect the innocent and obey his superiors and not to engage unless attacked. After the insanely cruel treatment by the sheriff and his deputies, he merely wanted to escape. He didn't want to kill anybody. He didn't want revenge. He just wanted to not be there anymore. Thereafter, they came for him, and he responded in kind. His military training and his battlefield instincts kicked in then, together with a sliver of PTSD. As far as he was concerned, enemy agents were acting upon him, and his training dictated that he had to survive by any means necessary. And let's be honest, he wasn't, like, completely wrong. Despite this hard programming, he still made a point of avoiding killing people. There was nothing villainous about his behavior. There was nothing anti-moral. He was, for the most part, a regular guy, military background and trauma aside. He wasn't a hero in the comic book sense, but he was not a bad person whose motivations were selfish or even amoral. He was literally just some guy trying to survive, a good guy even. And in future additions to the franchise, he wasn't even using his skills and training for himself, but for others. In many ways, Rambo eventually became a pure hero in the comic book sense, especially in the fourth film, which is probably my personal second favorite in the franchise. From an analytical sense, John Rambo is incomprehensible unless you completely understand his moral code, as analyzed without emotion. Based on his training and his conditioning and the fact that intense war trauma had colored his mind, in that small mountain town, he found himself locked in a fight-or-die struggle for actual survival. Within that struggle, he behaved according to the moral code that was so deeply ingrained in his person. Perhaps for a regular person, it would be somewhat unthinkable to engage in armed guerrilla combat in such a situation, but John Rambo's mind was battle-conditioned, while he himself still had strong moral fiber, which was not, let's face it, much different from any other person's. Almost everyone would agree that it is morally acceptable to defend oneself in a situation like that. There's nothing gray there. So taking that objective moral truth, the writers could allow Rambo's self-defense behavior to escalate just enough to allow the audience to wonder if there might have been a point in there where he might have crossed the line. A huge part of the success of that latter point is that the writers didn't spell it out. Leaving it open like that allowed the audience to think about it. And so what looked like a simple action movie instead became one of the most compelling depictions of post-Vietnam America ever put to film. Compelling not because it makes us uncomfortable or screws around with our surface emotions, but because it makes us think. An infinitely more useful sensation in any event. If John Rambo had been written solely from the standpoint of how his morals made the writer feel, then we would have ended up with a very boring character whose behavior was dictated by the subjective emotions of the writers. The writing of First Blood also brings us to another element of the writing of compelling but morally interesting heroes. In order for the reader or audience to immerse themselves in the moral world of the story and find in it compelling food for thought, that entire world in which the story takes place, as well as the way that world interacts with the characters, must be written with a solid, comprehensible, objectively moral foundation. It's a little hard to explain, so let's look at another example. Yes, yes, I know. This is my very first ever mention of an anime on this channel, but there's no getting around the fact that the very best anime... Animes? Do we know the plural for anime? Are miles and miles better in terms of writing than even the highest of the highbrow modern Western cinema. I've not yet finished Attack on Titan, but something that struck me while I was working my way through the first few mind-blowing arcs was that the writer, both of the anime and the manga, had an exceptionally solid and nuanced grasp of basic human morality. The first time Eren transformed into the Titan, as people started to grasp the unthinkable thing that had happened, his friends immediately came to his defense. However, his friends weren't just blindly loyal to him, although I think some of them still might have been. Rather, they were making an informed choice in choosing to defend Eren. This was evident in their tense conversation. The writers understood that Eren couldn't be judged morally based solely on how his actions had made people feel. So when they were writing in the first major assessment of his character based on this new development, this hard moral truth was central. His friends had watched his Titan's behavior and perceived that it seemed to be trying to help them and so understood that to some degree, Eren was controlling it and so should not be considered a dangerous threat. The rest of the world, understandably, was terrified at the thought of having a person in their midst who could theoretically transform into an unstoppable human-devouring supermonster in a literal instant. The immediate reaction was to kill him. This was not a moral judgment, but a matter of safety. Over time, as various high-ranking individuals became central to this significant issue, the question became whether or not Eren could control the Titan completely. If he could, he was valuable. If he couldn't, he was dangerous. That was the only question that was important. At no point was Aaron's morality taken into consideration. I mean, not in any relevant way. Many recognized that this was a good kid and a brave soldier who was a little hot-headed, but that wasn't relevant. In the hands of a lesser writer, the question of Aaron's ability to control his Titan would have been painted morally. He evoked fear in his fellow humans, which was a bad feeling, therefore there must be something about him that's immoral, right? But his friends were defending him, which means he's, sensitive. That means he's actually a little moral, right? Maybe he's, an anti-hero? Or no, an anti-villain? And so on and so on. This muddy, wishy-washy absurdity would have destroyed the intricate complexities of this incredible story, and it would have completely cut the legs out from under Aaron's development. He himself understood the situation. He didn't want to hurt people, but in his Titan form, he might. He himself questioned whether or not he ought to be allowed to live. This question was then reframed as perhaps a symptom of cowardice, and so on, cycling through endless examinations of morality, ethics, and character development, all because this character and this world were written with moral absolutes divorced from emotion. And thus the story, being grounded in a very solid moral foundation, was able to pack a much more satisfying and powerful emotional punch. All three of these examples are not comprehensible to the audience or to the writers as heroes, plain and simple, unless you can understand the morality at play. Analyzing complex morality is incredibly rewarding. It's also impossible if the only way you can understand morality is with feelings. Moreover, these days, the emotions of people in general, and writers in particular, have become more and more oversensitive. These sensitive emotions are then used to dictate morality in the construction of heroes. It's not at all surprising that most characters these days are just amoral blobs, despite the fact that they're very often not meant to be. Most writers will tell you that they have a right or an obligation to put their own moral opinions into their works, and that's, you know, true. The problem is that most writers these days, besides being wildly oversensitive, are forming their moral opinions based solely on emotions. However, on top of emotions, you also have the unfortunate reality that a lot of writers like to inject current year social issues into their hero's character, making him or her little more than a megaphone for what really amounts to little more than a rundown of the highlights of their Twitter feed. This is closely related to characters who are self-inserts. The danger of putting yourself into your hero is that you will be less inclined to give that hero flaws, and therefore a development arc, and you will be extremely sensitive to criticism. Emotionally, you and that character are one, making any critique of the built character a critique of your personal self. This prevents growth as a writer, and makes for characters that are difficult for anyone to enjoy or relate to other than yourself. There's also no getting around the politics of it all. And this is more of a problem with large corporate media than with those of you writing your own stories in your free time. An interesting piece of information that might be good to remember when you watch your next movie or Netflix show, it isn't just the ideology of the writers that informs the morality of the characters and the universe in which the story takes place. These writers also have to be obedient to corporate overlords, and so will bend the morality of their stories, characters, and universes to fit whatever the overlords say. As in the case of the animated Dungeons & Dragons kids show from the 1980s. Developer Mark Evanier recounted on his blog how so-called parents groups tended to dictate the content of a lot of children's television. These parents groups, he explains, are rarely comprised of parents and have zero parental interest in what they're doing. That is to say, they don't care about kids, but agendas and ideologies. As he said, consultants were brought in, and we, the folks who were writing cartoons, were ordered to include certain pro-social morals in our shows. At the time, the dominant pro-social moral was as follows. The group is always right. The complainer is always wrong. As such, this entity forced Evanier to include the much-hated character Eric as the anti-social and therefore anti-moral character. When the rest of the gang would decide to do something, Eric had to pipe up with, "Hang on, I don't think that's a good idea." Whereupon he would be crushed like the little annoying, pathetic coward that the show's moral landscape insisted that he was. Explicitly presenting a morality in which the thing that made Eric bad was that he disagreed with the group. Thus, on-screen morality in this case was shaped and formed not by reason and logic and not even by emotions, but in order to put forward a specific moral agenda that the makers, the so-called parent groups in this case, wanted to project out into the world, which in this case was any thinking contrary to the group is immoral, selfish, cowardly, and reprehensible. Eric was depicted as annoying and hated in order to fit this moral image. Which is all a very fancy way of saying that corporate media companies and their controlling forces often use the stories they tell to attempt to shape and form the morality of their audience. That's not new information. And I think it's pretty clear to anyone that that type of thing is widespread these days. Just, you know, pick your ideology. Speaking of forced illogical morality, another popular one you see all the time and almost exclusively in post-World War II is this idea that breaking the law is immoral. Now, pump the brakes, everyone. I'm not saying you have to go out and break the law to be moral. Far from it. Let's all be law-abiding citizens, okay? What I am saying, however, is that there's this weird idea nowadays that the law is morality. That we can only determine whether or not something is morally right by finding out whether or not it's illegal. How many times have you heard as someone's response to being called out for doing something wrong, "Well, it's not like it's illegal," or something like that? That's a really weird notion and not natural at all. The law is meant really to keep order, to some degree. We humans are expected to govern our morality ourselves. That's a lot of responsibility though, so most people hand that over to the law and use legality to determine morality. Well, as long as we're not breaking any laws. Well, blowing my entire paycheck on lottery tickets isn't illegal, so... Well, cheating on my wife isn't illegal, so... Well, sleeping with a 14-year-old in Italy isn't illegal, so... Because of this, tons and tons of completely non-ambiguously heroic characters are now considered anti-heroes merely because they either routinely break the law or they operate outside the law. So you have a character like Frank Castle, who is absolutely a plain and simple black and white hero, and yet he's considered an anti-hero because he actually kills the bad guys. I don't know about you, but I have a really hard time finding the gray area in the morality of a guy who went out of his way to kill a man who offered to sell him a 12-year-old girl. In fact, it's my contention that we as audience members are more drawn to characters like Frank Castle because the morality is so cut and dry. Bad guy does objectively bad thing, good guy comes and blows him away, rinse and repeat. That's actually very satisfying, especially in a world overrun with nothing but mushy, emotional, so-called moral ambiguity. It's also not remotely anti-heroic, which makes you wonder why he's labeled an anti-hero, despite the fact that he's a very conventional hero. A true conventional hero is someone like Odysseus, who stole his enemy's weapons before he attacked so they couldn't fight back while he massacred them. Because you know, otherwise he might not have won the fight and then his family would have been in danger. Or Brian Mills, who casually maimed and tortured his way across Paris to find his kidnapped daughter. It's not someone who wrings his hands trying to decide whether to kill or to imprison. How the hell many times did Joker break out of Arkham? At a certain point, that becomes villainous ineptitude, not conventional heroism. And audiences are instinctively aware of that. That's the biggest reason people are drawn to anti-heroes, who simply aren't anti-heroes, because that's the true face of conventional heroism, guys like Brian Mills and Frank Castle. Guys like Brian Mills and Frank Castle are real heroes in the tradition of Beowulf and Odysseus and even King Arthur, and we as a society miss that. In the past, such a bizarre conflation of laws and morals didn't exist, so you could have stories of brutal, ruthless heroes who were deemed 100% heroic within the environment of the story and clearly also by the author, because the author understood that laws evolve and change and are subject to corruption, but morality is straightforward, objective truth. But nowadays, you get a guy who's a vigilante but who literally can't even bring himself to kill child traffickers and he's somehow an anti-hero. I'm sorry, I just don't buy it. Or a vigilante who actually works with the police. What exactly makes Batman an anti-hero? Besides some random formula someone cobbled together because judging his morality was too hard or too scary. In the same way that people hand over the responsibility for determining morality to lawmakers, writers tend to hand over responsibility for determining the morality of their heroes to arbitrary formulas. What's the bottom line here? I've already said it 100 times on this channel, so at the risk of sounding like a broken record, you shouldn't use formulas or archetypes to construct your characters. But what you do need to do is understand morality, as divorced from emotion as humanly possible. Rampant emotional sensitivity in literature has been the trend for I don't even know how long, and the overall quality of literature in general, and heroic characters in particular, have been very slowly declining as a result. Aside from the fact that emotion is just a terrible foundation for a story or a character, I would say that emotion is just the highbrow way of saying writing for vibes. It also slowly erodes the solid moral and logical framework of humanity and of social interaction. Look at the difference between those early arcs of Attack on Titan and, say, Captain America: Civil War. That entire movie was built layer upon layer on these absurd faux moral complexities that were made up entirely of emotion, which is basically like saying they were made of cotton candy. Compare the opening situation with Wanda Maximoff attempting to get rid of the bomb only for it to detonate against the side of the building, killing people, to Eren turning into a Titan for the first time. The latter was arguably more dangerous, more unpredictable, more uncontrollable, but the morality of Eren's situation was handled with simple objective truth, which in turn created a far more complex situation. However, in Wanda's case, her actions caused unintentional harm, which caused people to be scared and sad and mad, therefore she herself must be immoral. It was also an incredibly poor attempt at painting an ethical dilemma into the story, given that all the ethics, just like the morals, were based on emotion. This was the basis for the in-movie assessment of everything. How her actions made people feel. The Avengers upset people, so they were bad. Eren's actions also scared the hell out of everyone, but never was it suggested that this made him immoral. Dangerous, sure. Maybe even too dangerous to be allowed to live. But what made it a lot more interesting was the clear objective moral acceptance of the fact that he was a good person. Because that moral reality was made abundantly clear, those arcs' major question, whether or not Eren could be allowed to live, cut really deep. Which is more morally complex and interesting? How a superhero's accidental mishandling of a situation made people feel? Or having to decide whether or not to kill an innocent kid in order to save an entire city? For the Avengers, the question of whether or not they were morally good or bad was lost in the mire of emotion. The emphasis of the narrative was on how they made people feel. So the impactful emotions were drowned in accidental moral confusion. That's the key. If you can establish objective moral certainty, then you can play around with moral ambiguity. I can't talk about Marvel anymore, and I think I've covered this topic fairly well. I find this subject interesting, the way the eroding sense of morality in stories has in turn eroded the quality of the heroes themselves. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts as well if you want to leave a note in the comments. I'd love to keep talking heroes. And I do intend to do another video on villains and maybe also anti-heroes in the not too distant future if that's of any interest. In the meantime, thank you very much for watching, and for all you writers and storytellers out there, happy writing!